UCCF's Be Thinking website, bethinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on BeThinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to BeThinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
So with that great, warm introduction, David, thank you for coming.
Well, thank you. You think of Greg as the organizer, the guy who has to kind of bottom line, make sure everything happens. But when I had what I call the heart event, I was taken into hospital, and he was the guy who stayed all the time. And that was tremendous. Thank you. I lived studying mental philosophy in Edinburgh. They said it was mental philosophy because you had to be mental to do it, but that was just unkind. And I couldn't stand living with philosophers or theologians, so I lived with two medical students. They said I knew more about medicine than I did about philosophy, which said how much I knew. And they were a couple of Christian guys. In the morning, before we went off to classes, we would have a prayer together, and then we would pick a text. Now, I had a lady from the Salvation Army who'd given me a thing called a promise box. This is a little box of rolled-up texts, and they're all tightly packed in, and you get a pair of tweezers. And what you're supposed to do is you pick out a text, and this is your kind of thought for the day. So there we would all, we'd had a reading of scripture, we'd had some prayer, and then we would pick our text for the day. And every now and then, we'd get a really lousy text. So what we do then is we'd put it back and we'd pick another one and another one until we found a nice, comfortable text. That's the trouble so often, that we take the text out of the context. And we're very concerned in Scripture to read things in their context, but actually the work that we do has to be seen and done in a context as well. And I want us, as we look at some of the challenges facing us, and I want to emphasize that word us, because this is not me coming down from Mount Olympus or Sinai with the two tablets that you have to swallow whole. It's rather we as fellow workers together trying to reflect on our context. And I want to look at our context a little bit, because we need to place ourselves. And to place ourselves, first of all, I think we have to see the rise of liberalism. The one advantage about Europeans is that we have a very strong sense of history. When I was a student for a year in Arizona, I was invited by friends to drive out to their little village called Cave Creek. And when you entered it, there was a sign which said, Cave Creek, founded 1872. And you thought, 1872. And I remember a friend who was receiving an honorary degree in the States, and the universities were all ranked in order of when they'd been founded. And I think there were 800 years between him and the next guy, because he'd come from Oxford. And that sense of history is very important. Our history is that particularly at the end and at the beginning of this century, this last century, I should say now, liberalism was very strong. We will not understand most of the theologians. I always think that, you know, to have written theology at the beginning of the 20th century, your name had to begin with a B. Bart, Brunner, Bultmann, you had to be a B to be able to do theology. But all of these theologians, we need to understand in the context of liberalism. And we need to understand our society today in light of the success of liberalism. Liberalism has won the day, and it's an ideology which is far beyond anything which actually can be sustained. Liberalism, that sense of freedom from and freedom for, freedom from any kind of authority, any kind of dogma, and a freedom for individuals to do their own thing, to think for themselves, and particularly to use human reason. There's a tremendous optimism that human beings will be able to solve all problems. Much of my work in the last 20 years has been in the area of medical ethics. It's very difficult in Oxford trying to teach people ethics because they think it's the county next to Thethics. But ethics, in medical ethics, there's an optimism. Should we find a cure for cancer? Yes, of course we can find a cure for cancer. Will we find a cure for HIV? Yes, we'll find a cure. And that's what drives many, many clinicians and medical researchers. There's an optimism that human reason, if you give it enough resources, you give it enough freedom, you get rid of all the bureaucracy, we will be able to understand and to do absolutely everything. The rise of liberalism. But of course also you cannot read the history of the end of the 19th, the beginning of the 20th century to know that there is a debate about Scripture. Now, Bruce alluded to that yesterday, and the idea that whether or not you can believe in a living God, whether or not you can believe in a God who speaks. Now, we as evangelicals take it for granted that the Bible is authoritative. We take it for granted that when we open the pages of Scriptures, as David Jackman's been doing for us so well every morning, that God will speak to us and direct us and we will learn from Him. But actually, that's really quite foreign to most people. Their understanding of the Bible is, I think, the hotel room understanding. You know, you open one of the drawers in the hotel and there you have the Bible, the Gideon's Bible, and you might be interested to kind of leaf through the pages. You might even read the little fly leaf which says, you know, if you're depressed, if you're suffering, if you're anxious, if you're thinking about your family, then there's some text you could look up. Perhaps you might even do that kind of thing. But actually, what is the Bible? What kind of authority does it have? How does it speak to us today? If we think that in many ways we lost at that time, the beginning of the 20th century and the end of the 19th century, if we lost much of the debate about Scripture, it's far worse that we lost the debate about science. Now, we have to be really careful to understand the science and religion debate. I think that in university context, there's a trickle-down effect. We won't you be threatening and talk about theology. We'll talk rather about the world of education. If you go to a school, whether it's a primary, a grade school, or a secondary high school kind of setting, the teachers there are teaching in a way which they were taught 20 years ago. And if you go into the philosophy of education classes of 20 years ago, you'll know that the lessons that were being taught then now are being translated in action in the classrooms and in the settings there. But of course, now if I had to go to a college of education, a teacher training college, the philosophy of education has changed quite dramatically. What teachers are actually doing in the classroom bears little or no relation to what is now being taught in the philosophy and colleges of education. There's a huge gap there. As I say, I won't draw any conclusions about the gap between the theological teaching and what's actually happening in the pastorate, in the ministry, in the preaching work of folks today. That gap in science and religion is tremendous because the common people, people like ourselves, grassroots people, have to recognize that our understanding of science is really 20, 25, almost 30 years out of date. There's a trickle down which really wants you to simplify. Teaching philosophy of religion, I'm sure some of you teach philosophy of religion. You'll know how hard that often is because philosophical concepts aren't everybody's natural way of thinking. And, you know, I try and use jokes, illustrations, stories, all that kind of thing. And sometimes you say, do you understand this? And they say, no. And so you give them another story and say, do you understand it now? No. And you give them an illustration, you understand it? No, you don't. And then sometimes you have to come to the point where you say, that's just how it is. You cannot simplify it any further. When it comes to science, what we do is we've simplified it as much as we are able to take. And the reality of science and religion today in the science faculties and in the theology faculties is very different. Science and religion are seen as complementary in many scientific settings. There are more Christians teaching in science faculties throughout the UK than there are in arts and humanities. There's no opposition in the minds of most academics between science and religion if they're in science. Now, if they're not in science, they think there's a vast opposition between science and religion. And that kind of mentality has affected people, and affected particularly what we call the man in the street, the man in the Clapham omnibus, is often the phrase. Science and religion, are they seen in our society, in our culture, in our context, as in opposition to each other, or is there a sense of complementarity? I've been amazed in the health service in Britain. I don't know why we call it the health service, because you only give it to people when they're diseased. But in the health service there, the secular authorities are looking to set up spiritual input. They're concerned about the spiritual well-being of their patients. And so they're saying, well, we need not just chaplains, but there's one hospital where they even have a witch, because they're conscious that there's an interest in witchcraft, and so they have a witch on call so that she can be brought in to help people, because the spiritual dimension of healing is part and parcel of a secular institution. It seems to me absolutely incredible. It's not the church saying we want to supply people, it's the secular authorities saying we want to have people, because the medical sciences and religion are not really in opposition at all. We want to work together for the whole person. There's a holism often in science today, which is really lacking in our context overall. We think of science and religion in opposition. Of course, there are points of difference. Don't misunderstand. I'm not saying all is sweetness and light. There's no disagreement. Of course, there's disagreement. But we have to see that in its context. We have to understand that our society is highly industrialized. One of the disadvantages about arriving late to a conference and arriving particularly at night is that the people who pick you up have driven that journey back and forwards to Vienna Airport many times during the day, but they perhaps haven't driven it at night before. And we, after a little while, realized we were perhaps heading in the wrong direction. That is directly opposite from Sopron. So we graciously turned around and we came back, for which I was greatly relieved. But part of the drive was itself very interesting, because we went through the industrial parts of Vienna. Now, my picture of Vienna is it's a beautiful, architecturally wonderful city of culture. And I didn't think there'd be any kind of industry. And it's the same with Oxford. You come to Oxford and you wander around the college world there, the university world, and it looks tremendous, the ivory-covered towers, all the rest of it. But you go three-quarters of a mile out of that central university area, and you will come to the factories, you'll come to the motor works, you'll come to industrialization. And we have to recognize that our people are not rural people anymore. They're very much influenced and affected by that process of industrialization. And we want to understand what it means for people to live in cities, what it means for people to have jobs, unless we understand the success of industrialization. It's also the case that different ideologies have affected us, and ideologies often have representatives. And if we think about psychology, one of the first names that ever springs to anybody's mind is Freud. And of course, the Freudian view of sexuality, the Freudian view of humanity, the Freudian view of psychology is only one psychological perspective among many, many. We know that. But Freud has had a disproportionate effect on society and on society's consciousness. And people are very conscious that there are psychological perspectives. Now, often it's a very reductive kind of view. You can reduce people to their psychological problems, their psychological issues. And indeed, I think there was a time, certainly in selecting men and women for ministry, where psychological profile was very strong. I've been selecting people for ministry for 35, 40 years now. And it's been very interesting in that time to see the changes in denominations. And I'm not just talking about one denomination, I'm talking about a number of denominations, as they were trying to select people for ministry, for pastorate, and saying, all right then, will this individual be a good minister, pastor, or not? And there was a time when all they were interested in was psychological profile. Will he or she have the right kind of psychology, the right kind of psyche to withstand the pressures of ministry? And they almost created in the theological colleges, some of which I worked in, a psychological pressure on people to give them a kind of test run. It's rather like I was recently in a hospital ethics meeting, and we have to look at proposals for medical research. And this doctor, a very well-known cardiologist who was interested in, and had a very effective medical practice, he wanted to do a very interesting research project. He wanted to give people a mild heart attack. And his theory was this: if I give people a mild heart attack, when they have a major heart attack, they'll have had a trial run, they'll have had a little practice, and they'll really do well with the major heart attack. And so he suggested this proposal to the Research Ethics Committee. Now, for some quite remarkable reason, that the committee was of one mind, that we didn't think it was a good idea to give people a heart attack. And we have a system where if you're turned down, you're allowed to come and give a representation. So this man insisted that he be allowed to come and address the committee. He said, "I don't know what's wrong with you people. I've been in practice for 30 years. I know that if you give people a little trial run, they'll do really well. So you're going to deprive these people of the opportunity of having a little mild heart attack, and that will help." And we had only really two concerns. One was how he would guarantee it was a mild heart attack. We weren't quite sure how he's going to do that, and sadly neither was he. The other problem was, we said, well, how are you going to recruit patients now? Because, you know, recruiting patients. He said, "No problem. I have 30 people who are willing for me to give them a mild heart attack." I said, "Well, who are these 30 people?" "Oh, they're all my patients," he said. Now, we were just a little concerned that if your doctor, who perhaps has saved you from heart problems and is looking after you, says, "Oh, I know you're grateful for all I've done for you, but I wonder whether you'd be willing to help me out. You know, I'm just looking for a volunteer. And, you know, it's only a little mild heart attack, and it will help you in the end. I'm sure of it." And are you going to say, "No, doctor, thank you very much, but no thank you"? Or are you going to feel that you have to oblige this individual? Now, that idea of putting people under pressure used to be in some forms of theological college training, seminary training, was a way of trying to fit people better to function when they got out into ministry, into pastorate, fulfilling their roles as ministers and as priests. The psychological perspectives. Now, of course, I have a friend, apart from Greg, you know, that's quite remarkable, really. And my friend, of course, is a Scot, you know, because Scot people, we have to stick together because we're a persecuted minority. And one day he said to me, "David," because that's the kind of friends that we are, you know, we call each other by our first names. David, he said, "I'd like to cut off one of your hands." These are the kinds of friends that I have. But, of course, when you've studied philosophy, you get used to that, you know, and you say, "That's very interesting, Arthur. Why would you like to cut off one of my hands?" He says, "Well, David, it would stop this really annoying habit you have of saying 'on the one hand,' but then 'on the other hand.'" Now, what we have to do, and we have to be balanced, we hope we're not going to get paralyzed with the hands, we have to look at the responses. And what I want to do is to try to look at the responses in light of these kinds of challenges. What I put down, first of all, are the world wars. It amazed me over the weekend to see how much time, effort, planning, cost, significance was given to the D-Day landings. Here were so many of the European leaders, whether from the German or for the French, all 30 different nations involved in Europe, all recognizing that this particular anniversary of something that happened 60 years ago caused all of these people, all of the organization, all that happened. And I think, what kind of consciousness? I remember my own father was on the beaches of Dunkirk, and he was evacuated, one of the people was evacuated, and often at night he would waken up screaming in a nightmare. And if you went through and said, "What's wrong?" he said, I was having a nightmare. And eventually he was able to tell me that the nightmare was of being back on the beaches. And back on the beaches being bombed, not by the Germans, but being bombed by the RAF, who had miscalculated where the troops were and were dropping bombs on the beaches, killing their own troops. And he said it was really frightening as the planes came over. You know, all the soldiers cheered. "Here come the Brits, the cavalry coming to the rescue." And then suddenly the bombs begin to fall and the friends are being killed. And here was the kind of the way that world war affected that generation. I look in student rooms. Now, that's something you ought to do. Go and visit your student rooms. In Oxford, when I was a student, I was never a student in Oxford. I went to a real university, Edinburgh. But in Oxford, they have what they call a university. And if you go into student rooms now, they all have the latest electronic equipment. They have video players, they have CDs, they have the latest. We as a college, we buy computers for the students. Nobody uses the college computers because they all have their own little laptops which they take around them all over the place. Sometimes when I go to a lecture, I'm confronted not by 40, 45 students, but by 35 tape recorders that they all set up, and then they all go off and tape recorder. And the reason is very simple. With the tape recorder, they can switch me off. Whereas in the lecture, it's a little bit more difficult to switch me off, so it's easier just to have the tape rather than the reality. I'm just waiting for the day when it'll all be video cameras and they all do this. Why do they have so much? If you want to have a real angry debate between faculty and students in Oxford colleges, talk about car parking. Car parking? What students have cars in Oxford. You can walk everywhere, or you can cycle everywhere, but they all have cars. And the problem is, where do they leave their cars? For the once or twice a week, they actually use them. And car parking divides the community like nothing else. Why do they have so many things? They have so many things because my parents' generation wanted to make sure their children were never deprived again. And people who went through war and the shortages of war and the rationing of war decided to give their children everything. Now, the generation, my generation, the baby boomers, who were given all these things, now have got a choice. What do we do with our children? Now, if you look at the world and the world economic system, we cannot continue to live in the way that we're living. Now, I say to my students, and perhaps you say to yours, you are going to have a lower standard of living than we now have. And nobody wants to hear that. They all think, and their parents think, that children should have a better standard of living. When Ivan Wheaton, the student development office, came to me and said, we'd like you to help us in our recruitment. I said, well, how can I help you? Well, you've got to prove to us that theology and philosophy are really useful. I said, well, isn't it obvious that theology and philosophy are useful? No. What parents who are going to pay the high fees that it is to go to a place like Wheaton, what they want to know is what jobs their people are going to get. And unless you can show the link between philosophy and a job, theology and a job, we are in trouble. Now, that generation that wants to make sure their kids have a job, make sure they'll do well, if we're training pastors, people who are going to go out and minister and to preach, they have to understand the way in which the psychological understanding of society has been fundamentally affected by the world wars. And that's going to continue. I thought it would die. But this last weekend has made me stop and think again whether that even 60 years ago, imagine what it's going to be like 100 years. You know, we talked about remembering the 100 Years' War. We're going to remember. I was making a comment the other day in one of the seminars about William Wallace. Now, William Wallace was a minor Scots figure who tried to lead a rebellion. But I will guarantee almost all Scottish children will know who William Wallace is. And not least because of the film, the movie Braveheart. And there they have an idea that... I went to a football match. And at the football match, this was between Scotland and England, they had a banner. And the banner said, "Remember Bannockburn." Now, Bannockburn happened in 1314. This was the last time the Scots beat the English at anything. But then, now, I don't know whether your memory is good, but I don't know anybody who could remember back to 1314. And yet still today, in schools, in playgrounds, in football matches, people are remembering Bannockburn. The world war has had an enormous influence. Response was to try to develop, I think, in relation to the threat against Scripture, an idea that we need to take it seriously. We hear many attacks on fundamentalism and on literalism. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm sure that very few of us have met one-handed or one-eyed Christians. But Scripture very clearly says, if your hand offend you, cut it off. If your eye offend you, pluck it out. We all know that we interpret the Bible. What we've seen even this morning, David was giving us an interpretation of a particular passage, some very difficult verses in Peter. And so there are differing interpretations. That's why I'm one of God's elect, a Baptist, rather than an Episcopal. No. Different denominations have different kinds of... Hermeneutics is on the agenda. And we need to do hermeneutics really well. We need to teach our people how to do hermeneutics well, but against a particular view. And against the particular view is, on what authority do we do it? I think that much of the Bible is what I call the little Jack Horner method. What you do is you put in your thumb and you pull out a plum or an apple or a banana or a pineapple. But you're not concerned about the whole of God's word. That's why the context is so important. And we need to look at Scripture to interpret it aright in light of the whole of Scripture. A proper hermeneutic and a proper view of the authority of God's word. I think so often as evangelicals, we assume hermeneutics is easy and we assume that authority is obvious. It isn't. It has to be argued for. It has to be presented. We have to enable people, particularly those who are going to be involved in any kind of ministry, in pastoral ministry, in apologetic ministry, and theological ministry, to understand the basics about authority and about hermeneutics. There was a sense, I think, in the church's response at the end of the 19th century. There was, I think, in Britain, a retreat from the intellectual battle. Now, I think in some other parts of Europe, there was rather not so much an attack, but there was an accommodation towards. You read Harnack, Ritschl, many of the German theologians adapted their view to the cultural ideas of the time. And they did that very effectively, so effectively that liberalism kind of won the day. We need to understand better where retreat is appropriate and inappropriate, but also where we need to be much more on the attack. Greg alluded to the fact that often you're invited to do radio broadcasts. And 2 weeks ago, they founded a stem cell bank. The first stem cell bank for stem cell research in the world is being found in a place, Hartford, just outside London. And so lots of the radio television programs wanted somebody to comment on this, and they invited me to comment. As I said last evening, I did 9 interviews over one day just on this one particular topic. And, you know, you think, why is it that they are so desperate that they ask a Christian to speak on this? Now, the trouble is, what happens as Christians is we react to something in the news. Now, I think we need to get beyond reaction to being proactive. We need to set the agenda. If somebody comes up to me and says, have you stopped beating your wife yet, yes or no? Then if I say yes, then I used to be a wife beater. If I say no, then I am a wife beater. And what I need to do is, hold on a minute, that's the wrong kind of question. You're limiting what I'm able to do by the question that you ask. Now, that's because I'm reacting. If I was able to be proactive and to set the agenda, and that's what we need to do. We need to think very hard about curriculum. In theological work, theological colleges, we need to think about what kind of curriculum are we putting people through and why? How can we teach the church to be proactive? Why do we wait until there's a problem and then try to put it right? Living in my little ivory tower, either in Wheaton or in Oxford, there are two curses. One is email, because anybody and everybody can reach you, and the other is the telephone. Now, when the telephone rings, often it's the hospital. Now, I know when the hospital, they say, this is the John Radcliffe's cardiology, this is special care, whatever the department is. Now, I know that they are now going to give me their latest problem, but I am not number one. What they've done is they've gone through all the obvious people. They've talked with each other. They've talked with the chaplains. They've talked on the ward, and they couldn't resolve the problem. And so what they say, well, what are we going to do? Have to ask Cook. So I'm last in line. Now, I know that when they come to me, it's almost too late to put the situation right. And so often in ministry, people come along, marital breakdown, whatever the problem is, but by the time they come for help, it's almost too late. We need to try to be much more proactive. in, for example, our marriage preparation. Let's not wait until marriages are breaking down before we talk about marriage enrichment and enabling. Let's begin at the very earliest stage. A proper right to a proper view of retreat and of attack. A proper response also in science. It took the evangelical world a long time to get itself together in the scientific realm. I wandered around the bookstall and looked at the variety of books. And one of the sections which surprised me a little bit, to be honest, was how many books about science and religion there are. And I was interested in who are the people writing about science and religion. And you discover that in the world of obstetrics, in the world of genetics, there are many Christian people who are really engaged. I'm part with some people from Trinity in the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. And 3 years ago, they got together and said, we've managed to raise some funding. Let's look not at the issues of today, but the issues of tomorrow. And the issues of tomorrow are whether or not we are going to have, crudely, chips put in our brains. No longer will students need to fear exams. They'll all be able to pass the exams because they will have an enhanced brain because of the kind of mechanization, robotization, the taking. We have people now who have mechanical arms. We have people who have mechanical legs, which can function. People who have mechanical hearts. Well, we're going to have souped-up mechanical brains. Not tomorrow, but in 50, 60, 70 years, perhaps even shorter than that. Here's a group of Christians in science who said, this is the frontier. Now, let's get some philosophers, theologians together, and let's work out now, before it happens, what the church's response is going to be. Now, we need Christians in science. I'm appalled at the way we waste the resources of the church. Here you have an average congregation. In the average congregation, you've an accountant, you've a lawyer, you've a practicing scientist, you've a successful business person, and they're all sitting there. And what we do is we treat them like children, and they behave intellectually like Sunday school Christianity is the best that we can do. There's all this gift, all this talent, all this ability there. We need to draw it out. And we need pastors and preachers who are so comfortable that they can use that ability rather than try to impose an old-fashioned, a very simplistic view on people. Christians and science have been highly successful. So successful now that the main media announce who is the Templeton Prize winner. What's the Templeton Prize for? It's for people who write in the area of science and religion. Here's the secular media picking up a religious prize and making much of it. And so that person's writing gets a great fillip, and people buy their books and want to hear them listen because there are such outstanding scientists who are Christians. The success of Christians in science. Sadly, because the liberal perspective tried very hard to say, we can make a difference. The optimism of the post-Enlightenment period was that, you know, people could pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. We could actually educate, transform society, give people reason, all will be well. This was the time of the creation of new, not religious communities, but secular communities that they really believed would be prototypes of what society should be like. And so social welfare, social issues, justice issues became the mark of the liberal Christian. And the conservatives retreated into their ghettos. And they regarded social gospel as something which was less than the gospel at all. Now, of course, there was a sense in which the gospel being presented was not a full gospel. But we've come in the last 30, 40, 50 years to understand that the gospel has implications for every aspect of life. That the Lordship of Christ affects every aspect of our individual and social and communal being. And that you cannot be a Christian without being salt and light. We have to be interpenetrating society. We have to make a difference in society. So again, we need in our training, in our teaching, to enable people to be that salt and light, that transformation, that social involvement. I don't know about your students. I think they'll probably be no different from mine. Mine constantly complain, all this assessment. I think this assessment stuff is killing education. But anyway, we get all this assessment, and the students write some kind of account of you. And you know, I read my assessment form from the students, and they all say, the trouble with Cook is not that he doesn't explain things. The trouble with Cook is he never tells us the answer. And that's what they want all the time. Particularly in Christian ethics. What's the answer? Never mind telling us about all the principles or how to think about it. Tell us what the answer is. And so I say, well, first of all, they're not paying me enough to give you the answer. Secondly, if I did give you the answer, what would you do with it? Well, what you would do with it is either, who does Cook think? Well, a load of rubbish. That's a hopeless answer. Or they'd say, well, Cook says this is the answer, so we must believe it. So then in 20 years' time, they're sitting in a situation and a couple come in and they say, this is our problem. And the guy says, no problem. Cook has given me the answer and here's Cook's answer. And they say, what? Who's this Cook guy? What difference does this make? I do not know and you do not know. What are the ethical issues in 20 or 30 years' time? If we only ever give them the answer, the one and only answer, then what hope is there that they are going to engage with the issue, engage with the culture, engage with the society, and apply the gospel in a relevant way to that particular world? None at all if we've only taught them to parrot answers. Now, it's not always comfortable teaching people to think for themselves because they might think different things from us. They might not recognize my authority because I've been teaching in Oxford for 25 years and worked in the seminary for 6 years before that, and I've got 5 degrees, and so you must listen to me. But why? Are we interested in people listening, or are we interested in actually enabling people to minister effectively? Social involvement, resisting a reductionism which wants to reduce the moral issue to this one aspect, which want to reduce people to this one aspect. That was the trouble with much of the Marxist analysis. People are nothing but economics. The Freudian, people are nothing but their psyche. We can have, they're nothing but their spirituality, their souls, not bodies. You just have to look at the ministry of Jesus to see that he was holistic in meeting not just the spiritual needs, but the physical needs, the whole needs of people. We need a holism, not a reductionism. We need a full-blooded Christian mind. I shouldn't really have written down all these headings because every one of them is a lecture in itself, and I'm sorry for that. But I think we underestimate the importance of a Christian mind. When Paul gives that very moving passage in Philippians 2, where he talks about having the same mind in you, which is in Christ Jesus. When Paul in Romans is saying, for any favor, do not be conformed to the world. J.B. Phillips translates it beautifully. Don't let the world squeeze you into its mold. But how do you resist that? Well, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. We're to love God with our heart and soul and mind and strength. I think that often those of us in theological education have failed to grasp the biblical significance of the Christian mind, never mind the practical significance. One of the first things I've tried to do at Wheaton is to begin a course on the Christian mind. And one of the reasons I wanted to begin a course was whenever I talked to people about the Christian mind, they said, oh, Harry Blamires. Harry Blamires, that was so long ago. Now, of course, it's not that it's not relevant, but we need something up to date. We need something which actually helps give a vision to all these people in the churches who are desperate to understand what it means to be a Christian and to live it out. As David this morning said, unless you understand it, how can you do anything about it? If we're going to do something about it, we need to understand it. We need a full-blooded Christian mind. We need the collapse of formalistic faith. As a Baptist in Anglican churches, going in an Anglican seminary, Episcopalian seminary, it was a very difficult experience because, you know, we Baptists do not believe in tradition. We just do things the way we've always done them. Anglicans, Episcopalians, they have liturgy. Baptists, we just have hymn, prayer, hymn, prayer. We don't have liturgy, of course not. One of the advantages about being in an Episcopalian setting was that you had to go to worship twice a day, 7 days a week. So for 6 years, 7 days a week, twice a day, I went to worship, and I never need to go to church again. I have a treasury of merit of church attendance, which is all there in the bank, and that's going to save me having to go. Now, what surprised me about going to church as often was the way in which ritual could kill or ritual could enable. That going through worship either was a genuine or it was a rote learned kind of thing. I have a friend who's a bishop, and he said, when you don't feel like it, the liturgy takes you there. And I often remember that as I kneel to pray and think, I don't feel like it. And I think, well, perhaps the liturgy, perhaps the Psalms, perhaps God's Word will take me there. And so often that's the case. We need to recognize that formalistic faith is not in itself enough, but rather tested faith. I remember Richard Wurmbrand at the Filey Convention. Filey was a holiday convention. People went on holiday, and to kind of make it worthwhile, they had a little bit of religion at the end of the day. And a little bit of religion actually gave people a lift. Often they were from very small little local churches, perhaps just a handful of believers, and suddenly they were with a crowd, 5,000-7,000 people, and it was very uplifting, as it is uplifting to take part in the worship and think of people from all these different countries, all the different backgrounds, experiences, all worshipping the same God. And Richard Wurmbrand was invited when he'd first come out of Romania and talked about his book, Tortured for Faith. And I saw them on the stage restrain him from taking off his shirt to show the physical injuries that he'd undergone. Here was a man whose faith had been tested and not found wanting. It was a man who actually spoke from the authority of suffering. And that's why the word of testimony is so powerful. And that's why our word of testimony, whether it's just a little side comment or a little reference or whatever, is so common. I lived in one of these theological colleges, which was a hothouse. And of course, we all lived on the same campus. We lived together. And the faculty had a row of houses. And we had a scheme called Prayer Partner. And each week you were given a prayer partner. And you were supposed to spend 15 minutes, half an hour praying with this individual. And it was a way of kind of getting to know people, getting to know their needs and so on. And I was given this particular young lady student one day. And I said, you know, it's a long time to pray, so why don't we just have a conversational prayer? So we were having a kind of three-way conversation with God. And in the middle of this conversation, she says, Lord, I want to thank you for David and Kathleen. I thank you for the way that at 4 o'clock they have tea together. And I want to thank you the way that they always have a prayer. And I'm thinking, how does this girl know? And after we'd finished, I said, I was very interested in you know, the detail that you knew. She said, well, what else do you think we do but watch what goes on through the windows? And it was interesting that 2 weeks after that, all the windows all had net curtains so nobody could see through them. But students recognize the authenticity of faith which has been tested. And we need not to be too hesitant and not to be too embarrassed. And in fact, whether you like it or not, your life shows, your life tells. We actually do, and all the ways that we relate to people reveal whether our faith is success in the sense of lived out. If we're dealing with the psychological perspectives of society and all the rest of it, I think what we need is evangelism, we need apologetics, we need philosophy. I want to make a plea for philosophy because I was in a conversation just before the Bible reading, and the man was asking me to do something, which is not uncommon. And he said, I'm not able to do it. All that I can really do is to try to deal with some of the philosophical questions. And I said, well, you have the really important work. You have the really important work because that's what undergirds it. You see, everybody's coming from somewhere. Everybody has an axe to grind. Everybody has a lever on the world. And it's at that level of the presuppositions that we need to engage. We need to help people understand. We're going to do effective apologetics. We need to understand the other person's presuppositions, but we need also to understand our own and to be well prepared in being able to defend that. We need a successful philosophical understanding as well as to integrate our faith and our learning. Theological colleges, I think, are the most difficult places to integrate faith and learning. And I say that advisedly. I say that because I know the struggle for myself in that kind of setting. And why is it difficult, I ask? It's difficult because everybody thinks you do it automatically. Everybody thinks if you work in a vicar factory, as I call it, a theological college, then you must be integrating your faith and your learning. But often, theological colleges are often very unhappy places. Places where there are all kinds of tensions, where the faith that they are teaching and the faith that they want people to learn is not being practiced in a genuinely godly and a genuinely community way. I'd love to have been a fly on the wall. People constantly complain to me about 3 years in theological college. I want to get out there. I want to do the ministry. And I said, well, Jesus spent 30 years preparing for 3 years ministry. We're asking you to spend 3 years preparing for 30 years ministry. There's something about being in that theological environment where we need actually to live out and integrate our faith and our learning. Time for questions. Three questions that I've suggested. We don't have to stick to these questions, but Greg, in his desire to make sure that you really benefited and to make sure that I really did the work and earned the fare over here. Why did Christians do so badly in responding to the challenges? The lesson of history is that we don't learn from history, and I think that's a real nonsense. We have to look at how the church has done well and how the church has done badly, and to be pretty realistic about that. Not to rubbish Christians in the past, but to learn the lessons for today. Why did Christians do so badly? What did work well in responding? What was positive about that? And why is there, I think, in the church, an anti-theological perspective? Certainly there's an anti-philosophical perspective. When I was going to study philosophy, people said, well, you mustn't study philosophy. I've been teaching philosophy for 32 years, and I've only ever experienced one person whose faith was affected by studying philosophy. And he had such severe personality problems, it was nothing really to do with philosophy. It was to do with his behavior and his lifestyle and his personality. But there is in the church an anti-philosophical, but an anti-theological. I want to hear your wisdom in how we can learn the lessons positively and negatively in relation to the context and the challenges, and then how we can actually begin really to understand why there is such an anti-theology perspective in the church. Or is that not your experience? Are people so desperate? Oh, you're a theologian. Please give me all the help and answers, you know? That's certainly not what I find. Silence indicates the opportunity for you to engage.
Thank you very much indeed. If I can just go to that third question, why is there an anti-theological perspective in the church? I mean, I think more recently I find apathy or bemusement, you do theology. So someone said to me the other day, so, you know, you spend your time sort of making up ideas or something, you know, that was their perspective. So I think often people just don't have a clue. There is the clueless and apathetic side of things. There is also, though, anti-theological undercurrent in a lot of situations. Mm-hmm. I see that more as a sort of traumatized reaction.
Right.
In the sense that I see the church has been betrayed by theologians, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of people who have done theology who have manifestly not helped the church, and who have, it's emptied churches. And I think, in the same way as, you know, a rape victim might often feel it's difficult to trust the next man.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, this is the situation that the church is in. I mean,
right? Is that common? Let's test that out and then say yes. Other people from other contexts, yeah.
How is it in other countries? How is it in Central Europe? Well, you either don't have good theologians,
right,
or simply for the lack of them,
mm-hmm.
or if they are there, they're irrelevant.
That's right.
Right. And why are they irrelevant then?
Armchair theologians, I've seen this even in my education, make a big difference between the professors who were involved in the church or a ministry and were realistic and relevant to talk about issues, or others were inboxed in their own thinking and the penguin thinking, black or white.
Right, right, right.
And then you get them into the church and you see the collapse.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's the irrelevancy and the bad experience.
Go on. Yeah, in the German-speaking context, you have hardly any evangelical theology at all. So
right.
You have no evangelical theological books and so on. So all you have is a sort of literal theology.
Right.
You rather have to fear that people are not skeptical about it.
Right.
In the believing church.
Right.
Not skeptical enough.
So they swallow the liberal theology then?
Sure, because
so that's all they have.
People have been brought away from faith through theology.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just the people of the church. I mean, my experience traveling around and teaching, at one place I was asked to teach a course on leadership, and they asked me to come back and teach a course on apologetics, and I said, I told Toby this yesterday, I said, why don't you teach it? You're just finishing a PhD in philosophy. He said, I wouldn't have any idea how. Postmodernism. I mean, he literally been swept off his feet by philosophical movement. And that's a pattern I saw right across Europe. Many people are compromising theologically because they don't have resources, they don't have mentors, they don't. And so he literally has lost the ability to do what the Apostle Paul did, say why Christianity is true and reasonable. He lost a whole swath of the New Testament. And that's not just that, but on many, many other issues, there's compromises going on. These are people are by themselves, and they literally have no ability to understand the issues, and they're confronted with a challenge, and they don't know how to deal with it. So they teach all their students that position that's a compromise position to begin with.
Right. Dan?
I agree with Pete totally on the apathy and the non-theological thinking. I think also people are scared, I mean, in the British context, because they perceive that they don't understand the relationship between theology and experience, and they think that doing any theology is going to quash experience.
Right.
They don't understand the relationship between those two things.
Right, and that's again the irrelevance and the withdrawal from the church as well. Yeah. Others?
In other contexts, people are unable to understand theology.
Right.
So whatever, you know, when we preach,
right,
full of MTH, PhD, when you go and preach,
mm-hmm,
oh, this man or woman speaks theology, it all goes above our head.
Right, right, right.
So
again, it's not real, it's not relevant.
And see, in fact, pastors who have less theological education, they are proving themselves successful pastors.
Right.
More than those who have good.
Right, well, that's very interesting, because in Northern Ireland, there's almost an anti-intellectual kind of view in the churches, that if you send a pastor to seminary or theological college, you kill him. So don't send him there. Keep him, and you know, he will be a fine preacher, and he will be a fine pastor, because he's not being tainted by that awful theological education. So
if you invite people for Bible study, for example,
right,
you will not get many people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right.
But if a pastor takes them to villages,
mm-hmm,
to help them,
right,
to give them food,
mm-hmm,
to pay them clothes,
right, right,
and
living out the gospel,
out,
right,
then you know, people join,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
because that doesn't demand anything actually from them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But here, when you conduct Bible study, they feel that something is demanding.
Right, that's interesting. Yeah, how do we respond to that issue about demand? You see, my experience is that I see that lots of people want to come and do PhDs. And I say to them, it's really hard, it's really difficult. Oh, it's going to mean all kinds of sacrifices, and the system is very lonely, you'll be very depressed. And the worse I make it, the more they want to do it. The more they, oh, that's right, I want to do that, you know. And I think I should say, oh, it's dead easy, it's wonderful. And then, you know, then they'll say, oh, I'm not going to do it then. It's almost the reverse of what you're talking about. The harder, the more that some people actually want to do the PhD in Oxford or work with you and that kind of thing. That's interesting, the difference.
From a Scandinavian Finnish point of view, I think it's a double situation.
Right.
It's the thing that has been said here is very much true, that you have this skepticism because the theologian is boring and because he's got nothing relevant to say.
Right.
But once you get someone who has a message, and if you could take David Jackman and have 10 David Jackmans, I could put them to work for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm serious, because there's such an enormous hunger for Bible teaching.
Right.
It's relevant, scriptural, and practical, and there's no end of those who do it. Have a schedule for 2-3 years.
Right.
Perhaps there is something to the psychological profile
right.
of a theologian.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's somebody who's dull, somebody mm-hmm. who's totally irrelevant. To
mm-hmm. Right.
And so, if you do not have these characteristics, do not go into theology.
Mm-hmm. So, what are we going to do instead then? I mean, are we going to give up? I mean, I think this is a very pertinent point. Whether or not, in the end, we're going to retreat from theology and do, again, think, let's get back and do the good works. Or that's the other alternative. I mean, there was a time, certainly when I was in seminary, when people were much more interested in the sociology of religion or the psychology of religion or the philosophy of religion rather than theology, because they thought this is kind of safer almost.
In Ukrainian context, there is a great suspicion for theological education,
right?
Especially among Baptist churches.
Mm-hmm. Because can you?
And even those who are interested and go to study, they don't have great support from the churches,
right?
The many books are translated from Western writers from different contexts and from different. Theological position,
mm-hmm.
and the churches just turn apart from that
right.
position, and so they are quite afraid. And nobody cares about the contextual theology, context applying the theology to the
Ukraine itself. Yeah.
So this is great challenges and problems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what's the prospect, and how can we get these 10 Jackmans that they described? I mean, biblical teachers. What's the prospect? That must be a vision for your country. How can you get there, and what are the dangers, and how can the rest of Europe help? Or how can England help, and the US?
I mean, there are theological schools, and they train pastors, but still those who got training, they leave their union and establish the new evangelical union, which is, let's say, a little bit different in the theological worldview, but still they keep the evangelical tradition, not very conservative, for example.
Thank you.
I would say that what we need to do, probably to have some pastors coming over, well, teacher theologians, like we were invited, coming over to our country and teach some people there, or take our students and go there, and so that they would come back, like me and Lena, and teach our students, our pastors, within our context. You know, applying whatever you gave us, like material information, but use it within our context.
Mm-hmm.
Because outside the context, it's not useful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Alexander would agree with me.
Right. I think, again, of the time where one summer, Ron Sider and I were invited to all the theological colleges in India. They came together in Bangalore, and they spent 3 days telling us about what the ethical issues were in the Indian context. And then we tried to help them develop a curriculum which talked about, well, how do we do Christian ethics with these problems, problems of bribery, problems of should you attend another faith's wedding, problems about sati, you know, where they used to burn the widow, and this kind of the relevant issues that they were saying, this is what we face. But there was very much at that point, and maybe it's changed now, I don't know, but there was a feeling we need some help in order to do that, to put it together. There wasn't quite the confidence that they could produce a good enough package to help them.
That's exactly true now.
Mm-hmm.
In our country, that's very true.
And this is Ukraine still,
yes,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And besides, you know, where Alexander lives, he lives in more, I would say, Orthodox part.
All right, right.
You know, like,
mm-hmm.
While in my context, we have 50-50 Muslims, Orthodox, when you see it's like 50 Christians, 50 Muslims. Right now, actually, that Muslim population is growing very fast in our family.
Right.
Because if you have more children in your family, you are getting sponsored by the Muslim organizations from
right.
Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
So they are growing really, really fast.
Mm-hmm. It's like Ian Paisley of Northern Ireland, Protestants versus Catholics. He says the only solution is to outbreed them.
That's what they say, because now Christians try to have only one child while they try to have at least three.
Right, go on.
I can tell something from our perspective in Slovakia.
Right, thank you.
I'm Baptist and we are strongly anti-intellectual. You must face, you don't need to think about it. Don't give critical questions. And because we try to be people who value, now we are afraid to give questions. Because to think, it can be dangerous. We have experienced that Soviet Union, we were told that Soviet Union will be here forever.
Right, right.
And we fought very quickly, and we are afraid to give questions because our structures can fall very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And because of this, theologians are very dangerous anymore.
Right.
Which are not to come to our church.
But there are different ways of asking questions. The ways of asking questions which make life more difficult and close down, the ways of asking questions which enable and facilitate people. I'm just wondering how believers share their faith with other people and respond to their questions. You know, if you're a simple believer and you want to try and share your faith with somebody, well, people are going inevitably to ask you questions. And how do you...
It depends where you come from.
Right.
This question is how do the West and how the East.
Right.
We are a different mindset.
Right.
Communism
right.
destroyed us and boxed us in
right.
poverty and all of this.
Right.
It is a wall. How do I ask questions? I bring them to the pastor. I don't have the right to answer questions yes. because I don't have the right answers.
Right.
He is the guy who answers the questions. Why?
Right.
Because uniformity has to be in. Theology is viewed as liberal West trying to bring in all kinds of other stuff
mm-hmm.
against our traditions.
Right.
And orthodoxy, communism, uniformity, all of this stuff builds a very formalistic,
mm-hmm.
fundamentalistic mindset
right.
that doesn't allow dialogue.
And is anybody engaging with those, as it were, givens of a people's psyche and background and history, the tradition, the Marxism, the orthodoxy, to find a way of presenting an evangelical perspective within these?
Yeah, there's one word, the martyrs.
The martyrs, yeah.
One thing that I find helpful is sometimes to say to people at churches is that there isn't an anti-theological perspective at all. There's an anti-conscious theologizing, but to say that people have a theology, whatever it is, they're just not thinking about it.
Right.
So once once you can show that.
Right.
And I think the second thing, I mean, my is a question really.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder sometimes in my thinking, I think the Enlightenment's all to blame for this. The separation of the church and the academy, that's what's caused this feeling. But then from a historical perspective, has it always been this? I think back to is it rose-tinted glasses to think back to a golden age, pre-modern Reformation time, when theology was important? Or is there something within us as Christians that always is going, there's always an anti-theological, anti-conscious
mm-hmm.
theological bent? Was the early church the same?
Mm-hmm.
Have there been better times for the integration
right.
of theology in the church?
Right. And again, it then depends what's our definition of theology, because there's a world of difference between, as it were, studying the nature of God over and against, here is my theological system which I'm going to impose on every aspect of belief.
I wanted to comment or add to what Christian had said.
Thank you.
In some ways, the answer seems to be working at the grassroots level with the new generation. As sad as it is, a lot of the older generation, they themselves recognize the fact that they cannot jump over the hurdle.
Right. They're not going to be able to change.
No.
Right.
So if they only will allow the younger ones to accept the new models, and this is why it
right.
is so important to have younger people who may be influenced, not by the West,
right.
but by their own situation, but the West can help to create new thinking.
But the contrast to that, though, being careful, the fellow I told you about was a young theologian. Just finishing his PhD, not even 30 years old, and he'd been swept off his feet because he didn't receive help in processing through things.
Absolutely.
So you have to think about the theological education that we talked about the last 2 days, and a biblical model of pastoral leadership, and a critical evaluation of the alternatives. So we remain biblically rooted and orthodox evangelicals, the whole thing.
You and then go on.
Well, I have two notes saying to what Christians and Andre.
Thank you.
First, now context for the 75. 5 years, we're always taught not to ask questions. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard for the students to ask questions.
Right.
In the classroom, and that's it. You sit in the church, you don't come to the pastor afterwards and ask the question because it was not allowed. So right now we have to come from that. So we are trying to make the students think, because they are just accepting the information we're giving them. Well, they are the teacher and the pastor is the Lord. He is the God. That's it, you know, on earth. That's a lot of people think like that.
Right, right.
The second thing is that this is not going to happen unless this younger generation is going to get older. Because a lot of old people think that you are too young to teach me. You are a chicken, I'm the hen.
Right.
Chicken don't teach yet.
Right.
You can't do that.
Right.
So we still would need, I don't know if Alexander would agree with me or not, but that's the church where I go. That's.
And do you mean just chronologically, or do you mean mature?
Yes,
you know.
They just need to get like at least.
It is chronological.
It is chronological, yeah. Yeah.
You know, like 45 years.
Right, right,
so
right. A stage in life.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we have some young pastors, mm-hmm. You know, it's really hard. And for you guys, for example, you know, well, you are, I think you're grown up like, enough to teach in our church.
Almost. Continue.
Isn't it almost inevitable that there's going to be a problem in any country that has not had a long history of thinking where people have had systems imposed on them? Or told not to think, that
right.
You cannot develop mature thinking overnight. It has to take time.
Right.
And the great danger is, you know, as the sort of intellectual discussions going on in the West are evaluated and appropriated to different countries, you know, the danger is either people could say, right, we want this package or we want this package, and what in fact they need to do is sift things very carefully. But what that means is I think people from those countries need to have a great deal of caution in their minds, because they can't stay with just a sort of traditional conservative boxed in, this is the package, that's not an option. But at the same time, there's just a world of ideas out there, and they're not all good ideas. And sometimes something can seem, you know, a nice new idea, but you need to reflect on it for two or three decades before you realize it's got a fundamental flaw. And so what it means is I think people need to make sure that the steps that they make are incremental developments, and that they're testing the ideas really thoroughly with each other before they're making theological steps.
I had a student from Mexico. His father had died and left him a theological college. Which, you know, he was absolutely wonderful. The only problem was Hector didn't know any theology. And so he thought, I must learn theology. And he arrived in Nottingham, and I was given the task of teaching this guy theology. And so I gave him a book by Jimmy Dunn. And so I said, now, I want you to read the book and write me an essay about the book. Well, a week passed, 2 weeks passed, 3 weeks passed, nothing from Hector. So eventually I called him in to see me. I said, Hector, you know, this essay, you must get, I'll get the essay. Well, the essay came. It was about 40 pages, and it told me everything that Jimmy Dunn said in the book. And I said, Hector, well, thank you very much, but actually, I could have read this book for myself. What I want is for you to engage with Jimmy Dunn. I want you to tell me what's good about Jimmy Dunn, what's right. I want you to tell me what's wrong with Jimmy Dunn. He says, who is Jimmy Dunn? I said, well, he's the professor of theology at that time, the University of Nottingham. How long has he been a theologian? I said, well, probably about 25 years. He said, who am I? He said, I'm Hector Espinosa. I don't know any theology. How can I criticize this man? And I said, Hector, unless you learn how to criticize and evaluate this man, you will never get a degree. But we'll never get our coffee if we don't stop now, so we'll have our coffee. I was very struck by what people were saying about the need to be relevant. And the trouble with being what I call a hit-and-run speaker is you come along, you hit people, and you run away, and you leave somebody else to pick up the pieces. And I don't want to do that. And so I'm wondering whether or not, rather than go through the other challenges, which I'm sure you're perfectly able to think about for yourselves, we might instead try to take seriously what people have said about their situations and about the kinds of needs that there are, and try together to find some kinds of strategies, ways of responding to that. I mean, I'm happy to carry on talking about the various things, but I do want this, you know, there's such a group of talent here. I want us to pick the brains of everybody. So if there are strategies which are working well or ideas that people have that we could be refined, I'm wondering whether it might be more profitable to spend the next hour looking at that together rather than carrying on through the outline. Go on.
I had one, taking up part of Leif's idea. It seems that the need for biblical teachers who expose the teaching of the Bible and who equip the church, that must be a great need everywhere. I really think we should try to think about how we can develop these in the various parts of Europe. And one impression I have is that in Europe, in countries where there is more of a culture of debate and disagreement, evangelicals fare better. England is has the best preserved religions here, I think. And countries like Germany, where students are not encouraged to say to the professor, I disagree, that's my view. In these countries, in that case, liberal theology takes over and imposes its views on students through these mechanisms. And where people are allowed to think and to contradict, the truth of the gospel gets through more easily. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, has relevance for what you described about Ukraine, too. If there is no culture of asking, I think in the end, it's going to be better to develop a culture of asking.
Let's, before we jump to that conclusion, ask whether or not there might be a halfway house which actually says, is there a way where there is a more traditional, almost authoritarian kind of setting, a way in which the evangelical message can be expressed, which does justice to the message as well as takes people forward? Something like that. Do you understand whether or not we can find some way? Go on.
I would like to suggest that maybe we would need in this case to invite foreigners to come to our countries and speak. Why? The reason is that I've noticed that people usually respond better to foreigners. Because they're not from your culture. Mm-hmm. They have different opinion. They're not going to judge you afterwards. Mm-hmm. They're not going to talk behind you about problems.
Right.
And even if they do, you're not going to be around.
Right.
And
right.
You want to find out about it.
Right.
So that's one good thing about our college when we invite Americans. I found out that, and I was actually working in America as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier for people to open up and ask questions to a foreigner.
It's much safer.
Yes. They're not going to give you bad grades. They're just listening. They're just wanting to know your opinion.
Right.
So maybe that would be helpful for us, you know, because we know right now each other. Maybe we can coordinate somehow that.
Right. But just let's refine that a little. I think that it's important that the people you invite understand what you need them to do.
Yes.
It's not just they mustn't just do their own thing. They have to match into your particular context, address the issues which are relevant. When Billy Graham came to Oxford to speak, he had a meeting where he asked us, what are the issues? What are the ways of thinking? And what are the illustrations from the media that will make sense to people? And I was very impressed that this man, who had a wonderful ministry on his own, was so concerned to make sure the preaching was relevant to that context that he asked the local people to give him that insight. And I think we'd have to do that.
Mm-hmm. Or a teacher, because we want to go through all the lectures they did and maybe to give them in advance a topic that they, you know, would expand and do whatever they want to, you know, to see what they would like to do for our college and then to work on, for example, on examples. Like, we're talking about 13, 14 today about Scott's winning.
Oh, right, yes, 13, 14, yes, the Battle of Bannockburn,
Mm-hmm. It's not going to
No, 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 quite. See, quite.
It's not going to, it, the same if we're going to talk about Crimean War.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, America would say probably, you know, or India would say, guys, what's the problem?
Right, right, quite. So it has to be relevant illustration. Greg,
I have a question, David. It might be good to hear people's perspective on this. As
right.
Well, what would they like to do for the next hour and a half? It's a unique chance to have the time with David. Would you like him to go through the outline? Would you like to have, try to lead a discussion on the questions that are at the end? I mean, what would be most useful for everyone here? Would you like to have him go through the outline?
I see a question at the end, which we are discussing now, what theology is for.
Yeah.
It comes at the end.
Right.
I think there's very many topics. We won't be able to discuss them. Discuss many of those, so we're going to have to decide.
That's right.
Would you want to go through the outline? Have you ever go through the, well, lift your hands.
I'm not offended by not going through the outline. Don't worry. Yeah.
Okay. If you want to go through the outline, okay, put your hand up. Okay. Yeah. There's about 7, 8, 9.
Yeah.
Everybody. Okay. Most people want to go through the outline. So.
I think what I'd like would be to select the most relevant thing from the outline.
Well, we'll let him do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll set aside the last least 20 minutes, half an hour for, you've got 15 minutes to go through as much of the outline as you want, David, and then we can have a discussion, ending with questions on based on the outline, and particularly thinking about the questions he put together for us at the end. What is theology for? What is the role of Christian community theology? And interact with David on anything he says and those questions.
Okay, what I'd like to do then is to go directly to the ideologies, because I think that the ideologies are more significant than the particular questions. If you're a doctor and a patient comes to see you, what we try to teach the doctor is the first thing the patient says is not the most important thing. That is the presenting problem. But behind the presenting problem is usually the real problem. And the secret of the good doctor is to get past the first question to the real issue. It's the same when you're doing a radio or a television interview. The first question, they give you for nothing. The second question is the really tricky question. And the good interviewer gives you the first question to help you relax and all the rest of it, and then they ask you the really hard question. And so I think that I want to concentrate on what I've called the challenges of the ideologies. I feel a little bit like teaching the phrases "my grandmother to suck eggs," because I'm sure many of you know as much, if not much more, than I do about these things. But I think there is a strong sense, particularly in the Western world, and I think that the Eastern Bloc countries now, because of the change, the change has actually encouraged a sympathy to and a feeling of relativism. The idea that there are no absolutes, no universals, either in what is true, what is right, wrong, and good and bad, or morality. Truth and morality, I think, are undermined by relativism. Because what it says in the end is that everybody's truth is as good as everybody else's truth. My way is as good as your way, or your way is as good as my way. And of course, your way of living, your way of deciding what is right and wrong, is just as good as my way of deciding what is right and wrong. And so the moral relativism and the philosophical or the relativism about what we know, what there is, and how we talk about knowing what there is. I think that epistemology, ontology, and communication are really the three fundamentals there. If we can actually grasp what there is, and whether or not there is something objective, how we know what there is, and often there, that's where the relativism and the skepticism come in, and then how we communicate that to people. It's interesting how many of the contributions before the break were talking about the way in which theologians have done or have failed to do good quality communication, and whether or not we need to take the context much, much more seriously in relation to that.
Right. Whether
right.
What?
Relativism.
Can we take questions at the end, though, so we can go through for the hour? And then we can, because otherwise, we're not going to make it anyway through the outline that everybody said they wanted to have him go through.
Right, but let's not forget that question because it's real. I was just feeling that perhaps because of the collapse of communism and the importation of anything and everything, it creates ultimately a relativistic kind of spirit where there are no longer any absolutes. And that's why people keep longing to go back to the good old days. It always reminds me of the people of Israel, and you know they're out in the desert and say, "Oh, let's go back to the good old days, you know, where Pharaoh used to look after us really well, and you know we got a nice square meal, and you know we'd work to do. Let's go back there rather than starving to death and dying in the desert." Relativism, liberalism. I think the Western world thinks that what it means to be human is to be free. And that's why we are exporting our liberalism, why George Bush and Tony Blair are exporting their democracy. And what's been interesting to me, reflecting on what's happening in the war in Iraq, is not so much the extreme reaction, but the failure to understand the context. I was talking in D.C. with some people in the administration, and they were saying that the situation is exactly like the McCarthy era. McCarthy was anti-communist, and he decided to get out all the communist sympathizers, particularly from politics, government, leading light. And what that meant was that lots of specialists in areas of the world, like Korea, were driven out. And then along came the Korean War. And there were no specialists who understood Korea and were able to advise the administration how to behave appropriately. And he is drawing a parallel with what's happening in Iraq, that there were not enough specialists who actually understood either the Muslim culture or particularly the Iraq culture for the administration to be advised not so much about how to win the war, but how to win the peace, how actually to bring about democracy into that particular setting. And it showed me, and this is what slightly concerns me about this, we can spend a lot of time on the need and the goal, but unless we have strategies which are actually real and effective, we will not achieve either meeting the need or making the vision into reality. There is a liberalism which is at work in Western mind. And people imbibe that so that they really do believe that they are free to do whatever they want. Now, they do not believe that other people ought to be free to do whatever they want. It's only they as a person, as an individual, who feels that they should be free to do whatever they want. And that, of course, expresses itself ideologically at all kinds of levels. In Edinburgh, as in Oxford, there was only one kind of philosophy, and that was analytic philosophy. I once expressed an interest in learning about existentialism, and I could barely stop the professors laughing, because existentialism is not a philosophy. That's literature. That's drama. It's nothing to do with philosophy. Now, of course, in the wider European context, existentialism is very much a philosophy. But much of some of the American mind, but particularly the British mind, is very coolly analytic. I'm always amazed at international conferences, and John Stott is a wonderful example of this. You have international conferences, you have leading theologians, Bible preachers, expositors, all over the world, they all get together and they talk, and they want to produce, at the end, some kind of statement, some kind of manifesto. And they always ask somebody like John Stott to draw up the manifesto. And I'm thinking, why do they do that? I've been in many gatherings of two-thirds world theologians, people from Asian cultures, African cultures, Latin American cultures. And when it comes to, we want to make up the statement, they always ask the Brit or the European. And I'm thinking, why is that? And it's because of analytic philosophy. There's a way of analyzing, of criticizing, which is second nature. And that's really one of the difficulties that in understanding the education system grows a certain kind of student. I was teaching in Korea, and some of the things that people said about the Eastern European countries reminded me of that, that no one ever questioned anything I said. And sometimes I was so fed up of this that I would take the extreme opposite view. And still nobody would question what I said. And I would say, but I just contradicted myself. Yes, you contradicted you. And it was all right for me to contradict. It was all right for me to talk nonsense because I was the professor. And when you met a Korean student, and these students, I use the word students, these were pastors often having churches of 5,000-6,000 people. But whenever you met them in the corridor, the secret was who could bow the lowest. You had to do obeisance, and if you were the professor, you must not bow lower than them. And of course, I was trying to show that I was a really nice guy, so I was going to bow lower than anybody. But by the time your head is on the floor, there's nowhere to go, and it's just very difficult. That the kind of liberal product is analytic, is critical, that's second nature. And what I found in the States is that people have lost that analytic, that ability to analyze. Now, we need to think very carefully about that as a tool. You see, it's a wonderful tool, but a terrible master. And so we need to think hard about to what extent we teach people this, the skill, but do not require them to use it destructively. The gifts that people have can be used for good or for ill. And we have to help people learn how to do this, but not how to be dominated by it. I was taught philosophy in my first year in Edinburgh by a very, very sad man. A sad man who was a brilliant analytic philosopher, but it had destroyed him. He had become totally paralyzed in his own personal life, in his relationships. In every aspect of his life, he could see all the issues and couldn't decide on anything. And if we teach people to do nothing but, on the one hand, on the other hand, nothing but to analyze and fail to help them decide, to keep that fundamental human will, then we really have failed people. So I want to encourage the skills of analytic philosophy, but to recognize there is a very dangerous price to be paid by embracing that analytic if you think that is all there is, if you put it with a reductionism which says there's nothing but that. And of course, the alternative in many philosophical contexts is existentialism. And in the European context, that's sometimes feels more natural. Notice I use the word feels more natural. It's interesting that analytic philosophy wanted to find a place for religion. It wanted to find a place for ethics. But the only place it could find was the world of emotivism, the world of feeling, the world of emotion. And so God statements or moral statements were nothing but either expressions of emotion or ways of trying to arouse emotion in other people. It was the world of feeling. And of course, that was second class. First class was the world of the mind. Second class was the world of feeling, which is why when people were talking about the problem of theology and experience, and the fear that if you do theology, then you lose the importance and the centrality of experience, is a very important lesson to learn. But of course, there's the other, which so concentrates on our human experience and fails to have any understanding of the experience. It's very hard in hospital settings. You find people in extreme situations. Suddenly, you know, they come in, they're not feeling particularly well, but you know, God's in his heaven, all's well with the world, and suddenly they're confronted with some horrific situation. I was talking with a lady just the other day, and she just discovered a 3-year-old boy. And she was just longing, you see, first of all, to have a child. She'd been longing to have a male child. Now at last, here was this little boy, he was now 3, and he wasn't doing very well, and she couldn't understand. And they'd been told he's a diabetic, and he will have to be on twice daily injections of insulin. And this lady was absolutely devastated. Now, she had an experience, but she needed to try to make sense of that experience. And so existentialism drives us back to that world of experience. But of course, it gives you, as Daniel was saying, not so much a theology, there is a theology there, but a philosophy, a way of understanding, a way of interpreting, a way of understanding the significance of that experience. And so, yes, we need to have a proper balance between the analytic and the existential. Scientists 20, 30 years ago, I think much more than now, embraced a kind of Darwinism. But Darwinism is alive and well in popular books about science. Richard Dawkins is the professor for the public understanding of science. Now, it's interesting, they didn't, and the university fought really hard to make sure he had nothing to do with the understanding of science. But they knew that he was a very good communicator, they knew he was a very popular writer, and so they created this special role for the public understanding of science. In other words, what the university was saying, and people within the administration actually made the statement to me clearly as that, is that Richard Dawkins is not a scientist, will never be a scientist, and scientists don't rate him, but the public love him, and he is engaging in the public understanding of science. It should really be the public understanding of a science, but they're not really willing to be quite as careful as that. We have to engage with the public understanding of science, which believes that there is an evolution. One of the other sessions I've got to do is on genetics. Now, it's very interesting in looking at that whole world of genetics, the way that people think that somehow nature will work it out. And nature does marvelous things. You think of horrific environmental disasters where people say the natural habitat is going to be destroyed for generations, and then within almost 2-3 seasons, you have improved fish life. The Norwegian. Do we have any Norwegians here so I can insult you to your face? No? Okay, well, I'll just have to insult them behind their back. The Norwegians complained about the Brits. They said it is terrible that British industry is producing all these terrible gases and they're all being carried across the North Sea and they're affecting Norway and the trees in Norway, and you British should pay us Norwegians for the emission of these gases. And the Brits said, we're not going to do that. That's a terrible thing. Now, forestry in Norway has discovered that as a result of these gases, the trees are much stronger, they're much better, they're much more useful than they were before. So I've been arguing in environmental circles that we should be charging the Norwegians for the gases that we sent them and for the benefit it's actually bringing to them. Nature seems to offer us a picture of Darwinian evolution. And even the very word evolution. People do not understand what evolution is. They certainly don't understand how it operates. But they embrace the idea and take it as gospel truth. It's interesting, we still talk about that as gospel truth. People don't believe the gospel is true, but they still talk about other things like evolution as gospel truth. That public understanding of science. And that reminds me all the time that in the classroom setting, I am not dealing with the public understanding. It's a backdrop. But actually, when you get up into the radio, the television, or into the public arena, then the public understanding is very different from the rarefied world of the seminaries, the theological colleges. Darwinism is alive and well. So too are the psychological and the sociological understandings. What I do not understand, to be honest, is why people in the States and in Europe think that Marxism is dead. One particular set of Marxist experiments has failed, but that doesn't mean that Marxism is not alive and well and flourishing, or that other forms of the Marxist experiment are still continuing. And of course, Chinese communism is not at all the same as Marxism, but there are roots of Marx in there. And we need to be careful not to say, oh, well, the West won the battle. No, the West didn't win the battle. I was intrigued last night. I went back and switched on. And here was Gorbachev talking about Ronald Reagan. I think he's going to be called Saint Ronald Reagan now, by the way. Everybody's talking about him. And Gorbachev said, Ronald Reagan did not bring about the collapse of communism. Communism brought about the collapse of communism. He said, internally, it was destined to fail as an experiment. Now, that was a very interesting analysis from somebody who was actually part and parcel of the destruction or the dismantling of that particular form of the revolution. But if you think you've won the war, dream on. Marxism is still alive and well and deeply rooted. I was struck by how many of the folks from Eastern Europe were talking about the mentality of people in those countries. And it's not just the mentality. I think the actual ideology the belief system. You can stop people voting Marxist if you can, and of course many people still do vote for Marxist or resurrected Marxist groups, but their actually belief system, the way they see the world, the way they understand reality can still be. And so with Freud, I mean, there are many, many different psychological theories, but what they all share in common is that they are psychological theories. They're looking at the way that the human mind, the human personality functions, and they believe that they have a special handle in explaining. I think the thing that always strikes me about psychological accounts is that they are explanatory. And we need to be really careful that they are offering us a particular understanding of what it means to be human, a particular understanding of the process of expressing human personality, and a particular tool. Why is it that so many intelligent people follow the stars in the newspaper? I turned on the TV. I'm a TV-aholic. And I turned on the TV this morning, and there they were, because Venus is going to pass today over the moon. And so what had they done? Over the sun. Yeah, thank you. That shows how much I know about astronomy. But even if I don't know about astronomy, I do know about astrology. Because, of course, what happened was immediately there they were reading to each other what their star sign said, because Venus was going to be in this particular planetary alignment. Now, here we have a very serious news organization which is reduced in its morning's programs to talking about astrology and reading aloud what their star signs were going to be, and joking with each other about how this was going to be a wonderful day for the young woman, how it was going to be a disastrous day for the young man. And it was done in joking, but there was a serious underlying. Why do people read the stars? Because they believe that they control what happens to them. They want to be, as David was saying this morning, like the car, nothing outside of your control, everything under your control. And if the stars give me a little handle on that, well, that's better. That's better. And of course, if we could always see what was going to happen, well, it's interesting to ask whether if we could see what was going to happen, we would be better prepared or not better prepared, better able to cope or not better to cope. But people believe they would. And so there's a tremendous concern about these psychological or sociological explanations, because they are explanatory. Nobody would buy Marxism unless there is some truth that economics makes a difference. And if you don't believe that, think about South Africa. What brought about transformation in South Africa? We can say, oh, well, the inspiration of Nelson Mandela. But without sanctions, without the economic. Now, the danger is that we think it is nothing but the economic that brings about transformation. We've been talking much about transformation, but there is transformation that happens in the world and in society. There was Reagan saying, President Gorbachev, tear down this wall, and the wall comes down. Not because Ronald Reagan says tear down the wall, but nevertheless, there are transforming. What it must be like, I remember visiting Poland back in the 1970s, early 70s, and driving through, training through East Berlin. And it was like passing from day to night. The west was brightly lit, and then suddenly everything was dark. And when you looked out of the train, here were armed soldiers in case there were refugees trying to hide under the train and be carried out of the setting. And it was quite frightening kind of world. And it's transformed. Now, that doesn't mean to say that everything is good and everything is better, but it's certainly different. Transformation happens, and whether it's Marx or Freud or a sociological or a psychological account, they offer an explanation, and that is very comforting for people to understand what is going on, to understand, and in the understanding, being able to respond and to control. I think the challenge often then in the church was they retreated into a kind of fideism, a kind of blind belief, the Kierkegaardian leap of faith, whereby the answer to intellectual issues was not better intellectual responses, but rather was a retreat into the world of faith. This was the what they called the God of the gaps. There was always room for a God of the gaps, because there was something that could not be explained, and as long as there was something that couldn't be explained, that was God's sovereignty, that was God's control, that was the God that I believed in, and I had to hold on to that God. Now, our view of a genuine view of the sovereignty of God is of the totality of God's control and God's role in all things. A proper understanding of faith is that faith requires a proper kind of understanding. We could debate whether we want to be Anselmian or not, but certainly there has to be some kind of understanding which goes hand in hand with faith. And so fideism was sadly often the church's response. And well, the responses there you can all read for yourselves. I don't want to spend the time in doing that. I'm interested, if we may now, in the last half hour, 40 minutes, trying to move from the challenges to the issues which actually face you. We're not here for people like Bruce or myself to come and just do our own thing and have people like it or not like it and all that. Actually, we're here genuinely because we want to help you do your job better. And in order to help you do your job better, we have to understand you. We have to understand what you are trying to do. What is the task? What is the job? What is the need? What are the visions and the goal? What's your aim in all this? And then we want to try to work with you. What are the strategies that will enable you to do your job better? Not for us to have free trips or not for us to do yet more speaking, but what is going to make the difference? So these last three questions, four questions, whatever, the challenges to theologians, what's theology for? What's the role of Christian community? What's the role of the Spirit? How do we practice theology? These were the questions that I wanted to ask myself. This is really, it's a very self-indulgent thing, lecturing. Some lectures you give because, you know, you have to give them. Other lectures, they say, we want you to come and give a lecture to this particular group. You say, all right, what do you want me to talk about? And you say, well, you know, talk about challenges. Talk about what you want to talk about. And so there's an excuse to be self-indulgent. And I try in those kinds of settings to say, all right, then, what do I need to say to myself? And hope that in you overhearing my self-indulgent conversation, you might actually strike a chord or give me some insight or some input which will help that. These questions were not meant to be the only questions we want to look at. I'm very concerned about this strategies. I really want us to spend good time trying to think about that. So,
what is theology for?
Right.
Linked to the last question, how right. do we practice? What right. is this to be practiced? How do we get to that point? That's the question we started this morning.
Mm-hmm.
I give you my perspective.
Thank you.
I think it's like a cannon and a projectile. What do you call it in English? Projectile.
Cannon.
Yeah.
Yeah, projectile is good.
You cannot have one without the other. I think the theologian is the projectile and the cannon is the communicator.
Mm-hmm.
Many times, especially in Eastern Europe, we have a lot of cannons. We preach forever.
Right.
But we don't have the projectiles. You guys in the West, from our perspective, the projectiles, but you have a few cannons.
Mm-hmm.
And in order for the people to know what to do, they have to understand what you mean by that.
Right.
And I think in order to bridge that, you should have some kind of a mixture or either train people that are gifted in speaking in order to understand theology and expose it,
right.
or associate the theologian with somebody that will take that message, that projectile, put it in a cannon and explain it to the church.
Right.
And that's what I see at least in Romania. When people clearly understand and they have a good communicator,
mm-hmm.
That makes a big difference.
Right, but there's a world of difference between having one good communicator over and against training 100 good communicators. I was struck by, you know, the 10 David Jackmans. You might only have the one David Jackman. He can only do one thing. If we can enable 10 David Jackmans, then that's going to be really effective rather than just the one. So I don't know whether we'd agree that we're more interested in the 10. And if so, how do we actually enable the 10 to be the good communicators?
We only teach people how to think and execute the text. And we forget or we do not teach them how to present the text to the world.
Right.
And how to exegete the world
right.
to be relevant is that bridge that Stott presents it.
Right.
And that's where I think it's a break.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have it in our mind, but the person on the street doesn't know how to read our mind.
Right. Just before we pick up this, can I just ask for a clarification? Whether or not the problem is they don't know how to apply the text, or they don't know how to communicate the text and its application. Which one of those is it? Or is it both of them?
I think it's both.
It's both of them. Right, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, I think just following on from that, I think we do need a bridge between academic theology and
right.
applied theology.
Right.
We're talking a lot about David Jackman,
right.
Who's probably studied theology, but
mm-hmm.
he would call himself an academic
no.
theologian.
No.
But yet what he mm-hmm. presents is wonderful theology,
mm-hmm. right.
And we need people coming to do PhDs and at a high level of academic theology, but that's not just what theology is. I mean,
mm-hmm.
some aren't even doing theology,
right.
because that is whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to see that applied theology in the pulpit is very much theology.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
in Oxford we teach one-on-one. You only have one student at a time, and you do. They write a paper for you. It's a wonderful way of education. The student does all the work, and you just listen and comment. And so you go through this. They call them supervisions in Cambridge. That's because they don't know what tutorials are. And in that kind of context and setting, I just thought I'd test the water a little there. You can only affect, I'm teaching this term, and I have 9 students. That's 9 hours, 9 individuals. Now, if I lectured, I could have 600 individuals. And so the question is, how much can you or ought you to do with the few PhD-type people? And to what extent ought you to be concerned about the larger number who Sunday by Sunday are going to be out there trying to help people apply the biblical lessons to their life?
One is, I think we need to deal with the issue of the compartmentalization of disciplines. So pastors, I think, should be having rigorous training in all the systematics, historical theology, biblical studies, philosophy,
Hebrew.
Yeah. So
cry of desperation there.
And the compartmentalization hasn't helped those who only do their narrow thing. And
right.
I think what theologians need to start doing is to do more of this integrating. So we have people from biblical studies, from systematics, from historical theology.
Multidisciplinarity,
yes.
Multi-departmental.
And
yeah.
And the other thing is, let me ask this to others, but Calvin had the idea that there should be a doctor of theology in every church. Not that he was always seen, but that he was helping the pastor, helping the congregation. That there is, so we all have these different gifts, it comes together. And so this doctor of theology might not be the best communicator, but he can help the pastors and who have got different gifts to communicate these things.
Yeah. See, it's easy for somebody like me because I work in the area of Christian ethics in particular. Now, every pastor's conference wants people like me to come and talk about what do we do about sexuality, what do we do about homosexuality, what do we do about marriage, what do we do about end-of-life decisions, what do we do about genetic problems, what do you do about fertility, what do you do about justice, all these kinds of things, because they want to know in their pastoral practice. Now, this summer I'm going to do one pastor's conference where they want to learn how to preach ethical issues. And it's very interesting because they're saying, we believe in preaching, but we want to know how to integrate the ethical teaching of Christ, the ethical teaching of the Bible, into that proper exegetical type preaching. So that's going to be interesting, a challenge to me as well as hopefully a challenge to them. But it's not always as easy as other areas, where perhaps the pastor doesn't see the relevance of church history, for example.
Surely a very good model has been developed in the USA. It's not always been successful
right.
in particular manifestations, but of an all-rounded
mm-hmm.
pastoral training in which you do learn biblical language, biblical studies,
mm-hmm.
church history, systematics,
right.
and homiletics
right.
in order to communicate. And of course, homiletics can't just be lectured.
Mm-hmm. No.
It needs a practical and feedback
okay.
element. But the best seminaries have done that in communities and with personal relationships with the teachers and that sort of thing. So, there is something that an all-rounded model, and if we're thinking about needing pastors to build up the church, if we're wanting, more David Jackman's, and I think that is one of the...
Right. Well, can we ask then, can we test that in the sense of seeing when your colleges, seminaries looked for a model of pastoral training, which model did you buy? Did you buy the MDiv type model, which is the multidisciplinary kind of thing, or did you buy that much more traditional, I think it's not just British, but a European type model, which was you become a specialist in, you know, the big toe of the left foot. That's what we do in medicine. We encourage people not to be whole doctors, but, you know, they specialize, and so they know a great deal about the big toe and the left foot, but they don't know anything about any of the other toes or the leg or the arm or anything else.
Sometimes the pastor and theologian is asked, you know, wider questions, and he says, well, what can you answer in this way? In this case, either you go say that, I'm sorry, I have to check up in my books, or you say that, okay, as far as I know, that's how it goes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes they think that he is the last resort. So
right.
They think that the theologian or pastor should know everything. And it's impossible, but it's still, I think, we have to have maybe the general idea about something,
right,
and then specialize.
Right.
But if you buy this idea to preparing our pastor, they wouldn't be successful in academia, for example. Probably for rural churches it works, or small towns, but in a big city when a lot of smart people and intelligentsia,
mm-hmm,
it's McDonald's pastor, everything in its ingredients,
right,
all
right,
its ingredients in pastor. Education does not work successfully.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think one of the problems with the MDiv hasn't been the MDiv itself, but the attitude that people have had to the MDiv, which is when someone has done an MDiv, they are then an expert in everything. I mean, I find it phenomenal that in the area of biblical languages, that someone who has studied a language for a fifth of their time for 2 years considers themselves sufficient an expert to talk about those languages in public, because you would never do that with any other languages except for Greek and Hebrew, you know, in churches. I mean, it's just absolutely phenomenal. You wouldn't do it, you know. I did, you know, A-level French, so I'm going to talk in front of 200 people about it. And so there is this problem. It's not just in there. It's in all areas. And naturally, if a pastor is in a church where he has a number of people who are very qualified, and I think there's a degree of learning that is needed there that will probably go beyond an MDiv.
I go with the medical field. I think we learned from the Sons of Darkness many times.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need the general practitioner and the specialist.
Mm-hmm.
I think the problem is, from my perspective, not so much that we need one or another, we need both, but the interaction between both is a big divorce. Look in Ukraine, look in Romania, all the guys that have been educated, myself right now I'm in the position where I'm without church. I pastor a large church in Romania just because I tried to tackle exegetical issues. I've been not martyred yet, but almost. And, you know, and I'm trying to go back into the church and say, wait, guys, I don't want to destroy the church. I want to help you. But they're afraid. And I think in order to interact, to put together, in that case, it would be very, personally, I would preach, do all the stuff for the church. However, and I'll have a problem in Jesus seminar, I'll call Daryl Bach. I'll have some other problem called Greg Pritchard, specialist that can help me deal with that issue, particular one. However, I think both of them are needed, but the interaction between the church and the theologian, that's where it needs to be worked.
Right, but let's look at, you know, who you are. Because you are here because you are theologians. There are people here because they're apologists. And I remember Greg and I were in a meeting where a lady became very angry because she says, why can't everybody come to this? Why only a few apologists? Why can't, you know, Joe or Jemima Smith just not come along? And our response was, well, we're interested particularly in training the leaders in the hope that they will then train other people. So we've already differentiated in that sense. And it's, you know, it's uncomfortable for people who get caught on the edge there, where they want to function in both contexts effectively. But how do we do that?
I think you already mentioned it yourself, it's the issue of multiplicators.
Mm-hmm.
In that theological education maybe tended to go too much onto the level of mass production,
right,
but not with the sense of, well, be it mass production, but for reproduction again.
So that
it tends to be a problem again of Christian conferences and things, and we hope that this network will not be that. It will take some of these questions maybe to those who don't ask questions yet.
Right. Mm-hmm. But how we do that, how we get strategies for actually translating the ideas that we're hearing around the room into ways of actually enabling you folks in your context, me in my context, to this better.
Well, I can speak to the British context, but it's amazing that David Chapman does what he does not because of the British theological education system.
In spite of it.
And what we need to do is to have, ad nauseum, it is to have theology brought back into or to be responsible to the church. And so people who are going to do postgraduate or higher level degrees, they only do that when the church has said to them they're going to do it because they're going to do something which is going to build up the church. They're not just doing it for the sake of it. They're going to do something which is going to build the church up, and they're going to be useful. And only when that happens, and that can't happen at the moment because there is still that split between church and academy. So we need to forget, in terms of building up the church, not on an apologetic level, but we need to bring the theology back into the orbit of the church.
It's interesting if you look at the... I was just trying to think, why is the academic theology like that? And it's like that, of course, because it's trying all the time to make sure it has a place in the academy. We talk about a safer area, philosophy. Philosophy departments have had major problems recruiting people to do philosophy. And so many universities said, well, why do we have philosophy departments? They asked the same question about why do we have sociology departments? Because sociology departments are collapsing all over the UK because there aren't any students who want to study sociology. But the thing that saved philosophy departments, certainly in the UK and in the US, is applied ethics. Because, of course, you have bioethics, you have environmental, you have business ethics. And so all your philosophers can learn how to teach people those kinds of areas. And the university loves it because this is applied. This is an area which is lots of consultancy, so they can make all kinds of claims. You get publications, you get publicity. And so philosophy is now highly regarded. And so they found a little way of communicating, which actually is making the difference. Now, in confessional schools, you don't have that competition in the secular market, the academic market. There's a greater freedom, perhaps, but there has to be a vision on the part of the denominational or the groups who are funding that this theological training is actually worthwhile.
I think sometimes in the independent evangelical colleges,
right. It's
actually possible to include things like preaching or practical skills in today's world for an accredited degree,
mm-hmm.
because in the more postmodern situation that people accrediting will recognize this is a developing the person thing.
Right.
Do you have at Oxford, for example, at Trinity, what I liked about it in my PhD program, we were 12 guys, and they will not allow us to come unless we have five years of ministry.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the difference between my Master of Theology degree,
where
I went right after I finished my bachelor, and this degree where these guys come with their heads full of knowledge, but also with experience.
Right.
And talk real issues.
That's right.
And it's very good, in my opinion, was a great perspective.
You're absolutely right. And as a teacher, I would much prefer to have people who have experience of life who will say, David, that's a load of rubbish. But the university doesn't. The university says if you have got the pieces of paper and you've got the money, you can come. So there's no necessary requirement. And I have designed courses where we've said we will only take people who have X number of years of practical experience or equivalent. We recognize that there might be some individuals who have had very particular experiences which might not be 5 years' worth, but actually have been so crucial and formative that they really are worth taking into the program. But it's very hard to convince university registrars, administrators to accept that kind of thing. Because, if you can get the money, you can get the students. Go for it. It's a business. You see, we often forget academia is a business, and nowhere more now than in the universities in the Western world. It's big business and big bucks, and you've got to make the business. We have a system of evaluating faculty. And each year you have to submit all the things you've done. How many books have you written? How many articles have you written? How many broadcasts have you done? Because in Oxford, one broadcast counts for a book. So last week, I wrote 9 books. Wow. What nonsense this is, you know? But that's the premium that they account for getting out into the marketplace, because Oxford University's name or Green College's name is mentioned. And so that for them. In recruitment, they say that the second largest recruitment factor in the college I'm in is my radio work. People actually, this is secular people, are sending students to this college because they heard my name, Green College, being mentioned. And so they said, I mean, absolute nonsense. But it's that sort of commercialized world that we're functioning. And the seminaries can be separate from that. They can be,
but they're not.
Go on.
Well, a big part of what I think is the malaise in the American situation is that seminaries are tuition driven.
Right.
And we are on the best way in Europe, certainly in Central and Eastern Europe, to mm-hmm. go exactly this direction.
Right.
Fill the place with students, have 250 at a lecture, and then crank them out.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think this is where we need to stop before it is too late.
Right. It's hard, though, to convince the denomination that we want to take fewer students rather than more students. Is it not? Because, I mean, that's what we'd be saying. You see, in Oxford, we say we're only going to take as many as we can actually teach. And if I can only teach, well, you're in theory not supposed to teach more than 6 hours. But I teach 9, and I have 22 hours. Some semesters I taught students, 22 students. But that's still not 622. And if I'd been lecturing, I could have done 622 in half the time. So what we say is, are you prepared to put your money where your mouth is? And in Oxford, it's very expensive, but it's expensive because this is a one particular kind of quality education, not the only kind, but it's one particular kind. Now, where is our or your segment in the market that you can still carry the financial viability, still carry the confidence of the churches that you seek to serve, and yet produce the quality of student that you want?
Excuse me, I want to follow up on this in that I don't think that we can.
Right.
I don't think that a Christian education can be a money-making business.
Right, okay.
It will be a deficit.
Mm-hmm.
If it is supposed to be producing the results that we really want for the kingdom.
Right.
And so if we can make it in a situation, I mean, I'm familiar with the system, although you call it differently at the other place,
mm-hmm.
of leading student one-to-one.
Right.
But I think we have to include it in a community situation,
mm-hmm.
in a general sense, where people study, worship, and work together.
Right.
And this for me, and this is one of the exciting things that I found at the institution where I'm teaching now,
right.
That this is what we want to practice.
Mm-hmm.
Not be tuition-driven, concentrate on a few students, but also make sure that these students talk together,
right.
Talk with the students, and be transformed.
Right, but then we have, you know, I am Professor of Christian Ethics in Southern Seminary. Now, if you go to Southern Seminary, it is cheap. Why is it cheap? Because the Southern Baptists are saying, as a denomination, we will fund 6 of the colleges, and we will fund them so heavily that any and all of our people can go for $300 a year. Now, I mean, the cost of education is dirt cheap because the church denominationally has put so much resources there. So I don't think it has to be tuition driven. But, you know, it has to be some way of finding the adequate finance to run it.
Yeah, well, become a Southern Baptist, for example.
Well, that's what I wasn't quite what I was recommending.
That's the thing, 5 minutes. Though, is that, I mean, that's there just isn't that money in the sense that if you look for job adverts in the main Christian magazine, what the churches want, they want youth workers. I've never seen an advert for resident theologian wanted for this church. And they don't. How do we tell the churches this is what you need?
Right.
It's a vicious circle because we're never going to get the money until we. Well, we're going to get the funding or the support of the churches until we say to the churches, look, this is so important.
Yes, I think to get the support of the church, I think we often see theology the wrong way around.
Right.
As a hierarchy with those at the top and going out too fast as the ordinary Christian. I think the most important theology is the individual, the community, reflecting on God with their minds and relating to God with their minds. I think that is theology. That's the most important theology.
Mm-hmm.
Pastors, if you like, at the next level of supporting that and helping the individuals to do that well.
Mm-hmm.
And specialists, academics, should be helping, if you like, at the bottom level,
right,
to feed in so that it's done even better for the
right
pastors. And I think if it was seen more in that level, that the ordinary Christian, you know, really from day one is doing theology,
when right
making any statement about God, it's not something different.
Right. Bruce, in his absence, I think I can wouldn't mind me using an example. I've seen Bruce in money-making settings, trying to, you know, to get people to give money. And he says to them, what religious books do you have on your shelves? And it's interesting that when they have books about the Bible, they're all Tyndale commentaries or new Bible commentaries. And he said, who wrote those? And he said, well, I don't know. He said, well, there were people who went to Tyndale House. And so if you want to have books like that, you need to fund people at Tyndale House. Otherwise, you won't have it. Now, it's bringing home the need, and it's finding the equivalent of the books, to an equivalent of the Tyndale House, so that you can actually help people understand the significance of the pastors and so on. I mean, I use it about, you know, saying, here, you know, think of the pastor who made the most difference, and then you just hope and pray that he went to theological college. Otherwise, the analogy breaks down. But if he did, then you can use that as a way forward. Go on.
In India, they propose a method of developing theology.
Right.
We cannot simply generally say theology.
Right.
What they propose is that you should go to the people. It should be people-oriented theology.
Right.
Go to the people. India is full of villages. And go and sit with them and talk to them.
Right.
What are their needs?
Mm-hmm.
What do they expect from their pastors?
Right.
When they come back from theological education, what they expect from the mother, and what kind of preaching they expect.
Right.
You know, I see the danger in this approach, but
right
basically I think it gives some sense. You cannot please everyone.
No.
That's true. We are called to meet the needs of the people. But the needs of the people may be different from what God has really for them.
Mm-hmm.
The danger is there, but still, the philosophy, I think I agree with the philosophy, sit with them and then develop a theology which has relevance to their life situation. That's why in India we have so many theologies like Dalit theology, feminist theology,
right,
you know, from Latin America, liberation
right
theology,
right.
You know, theology which addresses the needs of the people,
mm-hmm,
whether the theologians practice it or not, that I can't give guarantee. But at least, you know, they start with that. Then you develop a curriculum accordingly.
Right. Can we just hold it there because they need to change the video? And we don't want to lose the thought. Here's a classic example of where your work and effort and thinking affects not just the people who are here, but actually lots of other people who can have the joy of switching us on and off and learning what they want and taking it away. But I want us to hold on to this point because I think it's important.
And so
okay,
that leads
thank
us
you
to have, you know, if you are offering 4-year course, at least 7 to 8 months students are sent into the field.
Right.
I'm sure that, you know, is a provision in the curriculum in so many other countries also.
Mm-hmm.
But we have, in our seminary, we have, right now, the 3rd year students are in the field.
Right. So they will come back to us only in January. So
right.
8 months they learn to be with the people and do ministry for them.
Right.
And try to put their job into practice.
Well, there is certainly in the UK an emphasis on what they call on-the-job training. And there are many theological courses which are half-time in a church and half-time in the seminary or the theological college. And people do their 2-3 days and then they come back. And the curriculum is supposed to match up to their particular needs. But what we found, to be honest, is that it creates a tension. They get a little taste of theology and Hebrew and Greek, and they want to do more of that. But when they get back on the Sunday and they have to get in the pulpit and speak and preach, the people don't want to know how do we conjugate this particular Greek verb and so on. And so there's a difficulty about matching up expectations, and they end up kind of split minds, split focus. But that's one variation on what you're suggesting. Right. Right. Right, right.
Extension course comes near
the US. That's right.
But it is not part-time study. They are
right.
working, but
right.
They are doing this course. They come to us one,
right.
semester or something like that.
And that is really hard for pastors in terms of the pressure and the expectation because it's an add-on.
When we teach them, the question which they raise is very, very different from what our students raise.
That's right.
The students raise always from the examination point of view. Whereas they raise questions from practical
right.
point of view.
Right.
But sometimes they go out of what we cover. That's fine. But the real question which they raise is
right.
Socio-oriented and practical.
Right. Right.
Probably we have to encourage such things more.
Right.
Just to say that I really think it can be a very good thing to have a curriculum in which there is a practical element, like homiletical pastoral engagement, church placements during the training course. But yeah, it does actually have the flip side that you do dumb down academically, and you have to recognise that if you're taking time out of practical things, that's less time in the books, that's less hard development, and therefore those courses, if they're getting it to the same standard of use of the mind in trying to understand God's mind, then they need to be longer, and I think we need. Not to kid ourselves that is giving the equivalent depth of training in how to handle the Bible. I think it's important to keep the balance
right, right,
of the diet.
Right.
But you need also to recognize ways in which
I think the students should get into the perspective, what you say, Peter, in the moment that they come to the school. The question that should be asked is, what's your goal?
Mm-hmm.
Is it your goal to academics, or academics are a means to achieve a goal.
Right.
Or if your goal is to reach the people and be relevant to them, then you work within the means to put something together to combine academics and this touch on touch with people so you can be relevant when you finish. Otherwise, your means can be transformed in a goal and you're gone.
You see, it's interesting to me, one of Greg's skills is in the area of communications. But I don't know very many theological colleges in Britain who have anybody who really knows anything about communication skills. Some of the seminaries in the States do, but not in the UK scene. And maybe if we're really concerned about how to communicate and to reach people, that's what we ought to be teaching. Communication skills, not just the preaching skills, but how do we actually communicate, or the pastoral skills, how do we get alongside people, how do we answer the questions that they're actually asking rather than the ones we think they should ask.
It's also a thing about purpose. I mean, a lot of the students that I work with have gone to study theology at university, and of course a lot of them, they have no clue why they're going to study theology at university. It's just something to do. Well, there's hundreds of different reasons why they're doing
right.
it. So no wonder I find apathy, why we try to shake them out and say, you engage in there thinking, I'm here because the beer was cheap. There's like loads and lots of different reasons. And until we have the reason why they are studying theology, and unless they do have a reason, and you're going to encounter this apathy, aren't you?
I don't want us to descend into too general a conversation. I want us to hold back to this notion of the strategies And I want to hear whether people have had particular strategies which have been successful. We have two or three different models.
I think two different things in this strategy. One is that we need much more of this that you mentioned a while ago about, like, go to the preachers and the pastors and teach them how to teach ethics,
right,
for example. Yeah. That's a very practical thing. If you have a church and you never preach, like, anything on the ethical questions, soon the people in the church will live lives that break all biblical ethics. And just one example came to my mind about, I don't know in England and the other places, but in Scandinavia we have a huge problem with Christian youth moving in together before their marriage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they don't marry anymore. They just move together.
Cohabitation, we call it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but one problem is no one is preaching against.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no one is saying anything.
Right.
And maybe one reason is they don't know how to say it in a loving and intelligent way, so
right,
that it could be believable. So we need to train them. This is so very practical.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the second thing I'm thinking of is having people come, younger preachers and younger theologians come and do the work in practice together with an older theologian.
Right.
I think
right,
that's one of the best things you can do and learn together. Go
right,
out together preaching, teaching.
Right. I'm just wondering whether or not maybe part of our problem is we think of theological training as you do 3 years and that's the same forever. You see, this was the problem in medicine. We talked about the medical model. They used to say you do 6 years of medical training, then you do some general medicine, and then you specialize. But now more and more we're saying doctors need to be retrained. And so they're coming back, and government in the UK has put enormous sums of money to entice doctors and require doctors to go back to school to learn the latest in genetics, the latest in oncology, and so on. And maybe this idea that once you've had your 3 years theological education, that's the end of it. And to find a way of reaching those who are every day sitting where people sit, listening to people ministry, every week preaching and giving them some kind of input, which isn't the extension degree, which means you've got to add on vast amounts, but actually is very need-oriented and directed to particular skill practices that they might need. I mean, I don't know, I'm just throwing it out. And then Greg. Go on.
The Austrian churches I'm working with, they would all agree that it's important for a doctor to learn again, to go back to learning, but they don't see any need for theologians, that they would be theologians. And there's a certain kind of argument which comes up always again and again. And I would really like to know which strategy to...
Right. That's good.
How to confront this kind of argument. Something they always say is... there's no use in engaging all those intellectual types. Those people aren't Christians anyway, so that's not the right strategy to reach those people. They have to become Christians first. They have to be evangelized. Then they somehow think right anyway. But before that, there's no use, no meaning in that intellectual battle.
Right. Well, here's the challenge. We're going to have some response.
Yeah, so I've got a colleague in university who says that he always takes the attitude that you're not, as an academic, you're not there to reach your contemporaries, you're there to reach the next generation. And I'm not, on the whole, trying to change the minds of 30, 40, 50-year-old scholars, except in smallish areas. I'm not there going to change their paradigm. On the other hand, you know, I've got 18-year-old students, 19-year-old students. They are very open to changing their minds in some cases. And so I think what you're there to do, if you like, is sometimes to spar in public with these people so that the younger generation can say, look, we've got a guy up there who's taking the issue on and is giving credible arguments. And so I think that's what you're trying to do. So it in fact affirms their point that yes, a lot of these people have so given their mind over that you can't change it.
Greg, good.
I think all three of the past comments are all focusing on the same thing, the issue of cohabitation, that even within the churches, the biblical message doesn't seem credible of sexual ethics. The idea, how can we communicate, why should we even try to communicate to these non-Christians understanding these intellectual issues, let's just evangelize them. Mm-hmm. They're both apologetic issues. The one, the issue of Stefan Gustafsson every year in his curriculum, leading, I think, apologists in the Nordic countries, brings in 50 Christians, college age, who do a year of apologetics in Christian life, and he spends an enormous amount of time going through the apologetic for sexual ethics, the understanding of the power and the relevance, the credibility and the wholesomeness of life, why sin is leads to brokenness, and how living a life of purity leads to wholeness. I mean, just a wonderful leading into sexual ethics. In other words, it needs to be prefaced by apologetics. That's why we're here. We're all here because we live in a pagan covenant. We teach in a pagan covenant that people don't believe. So it has to be wedded. Teaching good theology has to be often wedded, whether it's talking to a young believer that's being compromised or potentially compromised in sexual ethics, or whether it's the idea of communicating the gospel to non-believers, the need for apologetically interacting with them, that Jesus, the Apostle Paul didn't just proclaim the truth, but we would lost the whole thing of persuasion. The two aspects of communicating the gospel, one of proclamation, one of persuasion, this whole recovery that we're trying to engage in. And lastly, here, the same thing. You're trying to articulate the value of the need to show a credible answer to these alternatives. All of these things are interacting. All of them are interacting with what David has given his life to. Doing debates in the Oxford University, showing the credibility of the gospel. I think this is all connected, and it shows the impact and the value and the necessity of wedding a theological vision with an apologetic vision, that they're absolutely connected here today.
There's a slogan in the back of a car, which is very popular in the UK, and it says, "If you can read this, thank a teacher." And people recognize they can read it because somebody taught them to read. And therefore, teachers matter. And it was a way of trying to raise the consciousness that teachers matter. Now people have to see that need, their particular needs being met. And the people who meet the needs are the people that we are enabling and training and teaching, whether in proclamation or whether in persuasion. But we need to be able to do that. We're going to take just a 5-minute break now.
We have 10 minutes left.
Yeah, I understand that, but I'm keen to move into the next session. So we're going to take a toilet break now. Somebody's going to collect the food for us, and then we can move into this second part. That's all right. Thank you for coming, and thank you for sharing. And I hope you're going to stay around, because we're going to get the food. And Greg, over to you.
If anybody wants to stay around, you don't have to stay around. We're going to have somebody talking to you.